Hey, it's Christine from Storyworthy. Today on the show, author and writer Ralph Blumenthal talks about his new book, The Believer, and a book tour gone wrong.
You know, it used to be commercial pilots, do not mention UFOs. You'll lose your license. We don't want to hear about it, UFOs. Now we've really come a long way with the government saying, we want these reports. That was my last stop on the book tour. And so for me, it was like 2 a.m. I unpacked my bags, I laid out my toiletries, and got ready to go to bed. I was exhausted. I'm an investigative reporter, and I can't find the bed.
Today on the show, author and writer Ralph Blumenthal talks about a book tour gone wrong and his new book, The Believer, Alien Encounters, Hard Science, and the Passion of John Mack. Stay close.
Hey, my name is Ralph Blumenthal, and you're listening to Storyworthy.
Welcome to Storyworthy. My name is Christine Blackburn, and I'm coming to you from Los Angeles, California. Whether you're a longtime fan of the show of over 10 years, or you're a new listener, welcome to the show. Now, I hope you guys enjoyed the show last week with film critic Corey Coleman. Corey Coleman was such an interesting guy, a true artist, and a really interesting person. We laughed our whole way through. His story was about him waking up drunk with a mariachi guy, which is like, yeah, what a bizarre topic, right, Ralph? But these people meet in a room, and then there's like, whatever, 24 of them. And then they, with whatever's in there, there's different props and stuff. They get to pick up what they want, and they drink, and then make a film and bring it back in like 4 hours. I mean, just something really silly.
It sounds like a tautology drunk film festival. What are the ones that aren't drunk? Okay.
Exactly. So you guys go back and listen to Corey, but not today, because today I have another really interesting guy who's also not a comedian, but he was a reporter for the New York Times for, I mean, like 40 years, from 1964 to 2009. So it's really a shockingly huge amount of work you've done, Ralph. And you've also been writing a lot of great books, crime reporting and cultural history. You have a brand new one out called The Believer, Alien Encounters, Hard Science, and the Passion of John Mack. That's out right now. That's, like I said, where I met you at a virtual book event for Skylight Books. But today, we're going to talk about that for sure, because I was blown away by you and Dan. Your conversation was fantastic. But today, we're going to talk about your other very popular book, which was about the mafia. And you wrote that in 1992, right?
That was early. It was even 1988, actually.
Wow. And how did you choose that topic?
Like everything, it chose me. The Times assigned me to cover this trial. It's called the Pizza Connection Trial of mafia guys who are running a billion-dollar drug ring out of pizzerias because, you know, pizzas come in and pizzas go out and no one knows what's in the box. It turns out to be cash and heroin. So that was the story. So I got assigned to the trial, and one thing led to another. Just like the John Mack story, it sort of dropped into my lap.
Now, the John Mack story you're referring to is the book out now, The Believer. And that's about a Harvard psychiatrist who went on to learn about and he investigated, you know, UFOs, aliens, all of it.
Right.
How did that fall in your lap?
Well, I picked up one of his books. I was a correspondent for the New York Times in Texas, and I picked up one of John Mack's books, and I was enthralled. You know, what's a Harvard psychiatrist doing investigating aliens and alien abduction? And it turned out he had heard about it. Some of his patients or subjects, whichever he wanted to call them, told him these amazing stories about getting beamed up onto UFOs and having, you know, reproductive experiments and producing a hybrid race and, you know, absolutely crazy stuff. And the more he looked into it, the more he found he couldn't explain it by any other means. He was a psychiatrist. He knew they weren't crazy. They weren't making it up because the stories they told were so affecting to them. They were crying. They were recreating it. They were, you know, they were weeping. They were traumatized. So he concluded that something real had happened to these people on some level of reality. It wasn't everyday reality because we don't see it happening, you know, in front of us on the street, but it was happening to them somehow, somewhere, and he was trying to figure out what that was. So he got, you know, Harvard didn't like that very much. They put him under investigation. They eventually cleared him of any wrongdoing. But he brought a lot of light to the subject of alien abduction, and he made it a really serious discipline. A lot of experts have written about it since then, and I've studied it. Other people have studied it, and the answer is there is no answer that we can understand. Something happens to these people. Some people are singled out for these experiences, interactions with alien beings. But more than that, we don't really know.
And so John Mack had several patients telling him the same story. Is that what you're saying?
Many patients. And they came from a big cross-section of humanity, including young children, who said, little man, take me into the sky. I fly in the sky. And you can't accuse a two-year-old child of being influenced by, you know, the books he read or the movies he saw. I mean, he's just telling an experience that he had.
And he was working at Harvard at the time?
He was indeed, and he actually presented his research at Harvard, which was really amazing. Harvard audiences heard him, you know, tell these stories, and they were blown away. They didn't know how to take it.
And he was a Pulitzer Prize-winning biographer.
Yeah, he went to see the movie Lawrence of Arabia, like we all did in the movies, only he went one better. He decided he was going to do a biography of the real Lawrence. And he went to England and he studied Lawrence for 12 years. He went to the Middle East and he wrote this book that won the Pulitzer Prize.
Unbelievable. That is really fascinating. It took him 12 years.
Yeah, he spent 12 years. And he had written books on nightmares. He had written books on childhood development. I mean, he was a very, very smart guy, a very, a distinguished psychiatrist. So afterwards, people could not accuse him of not knowing what he was talking about. They couldn't say, oh, these people are dreaming these experiences. It was a nightmare. You don't understand. He understood. I mean, that was his field.
Since he was in England, did he ever write about Stonehenge?
He actually visited Stonehenge with his wife. We have pictures in the book of him at Stonehenge. He was interested. He visited crop circles in England. He was very interested in the whole range of paranormal experiences. He started off with alien abduction, but he investigated, Bigfoot and life after death and animal mutilations and all the things that seem literally out of this world. In the end, I think he came to realize that they were all connected in some way. There are a whole bunch of experiences that test our understanding of reality. We don't understand any of them, but they penetrate our reality in some way, and it's a mystery.
Now, Vanity Fair took one of his works and put it in their magazine 2013.
I did that. I mean,
you did that. So
yeah, when I was writing, I was investigating John Mack. I mean, pulling stuff together for a book. So I wrote an article on the information I had gotten up till then, and I wrote it in Vanity Fair because this is interesting. There was a place in Newport, Rhode Island, a beautiful marina on the water, hotel where people who had these experiences would come every year. For a week, and they would share their experiences of alien abductions and John Mack would go to these things. So I went there. John Mack was already dead when I got there, but the people were there, and they told me the stories.
Interesting. Were the people there, had they known John then?
Oh, yeah. They had told their stories to him, and he was very much a presence, unseen presence at these gatherings when I got there, but he was a esteemed member of this group.
How did he die? How old was he?
He was almost 75. He was run over in London. He had gone back for a conference on Lawrence of Arabia long after his Pulitzer Prize winning book was published. You know, he got out of the underground one night and looked the wrong way down the street, which happens in London. You know, they
really
drive
does.
On the other side. So he got run down. Yeah. The guy had been drinking, and he was killed.
Yeah. Oh, that's tragic. I have a friend who stepped off the curb and got hit by a car. Just broke her leg. They took really good care of her, but yeah, it's fucking real. Like, that's a real
and
thing.
And in England, it's a much bigger problem because, you know, Americans go there and they don't know which way to look and they get run down. And a lot of people thought at the time that he was assassinated because he was so controversial. And there were all kinds of conspiracy theories floating around that John Mack was killed. You know, he was a victim of a hit and all that. But I checked it out for my book and I got the police reports and that's not true.
So, Ralph, when you come upon a topic like this, do you just like, is your whole life encompassed with that? I mean, does your wife like, hey, Ralph, come on, we got to have dinner?
She says that all the time. well, what happens is, you know, the book finds you. You know, when you come across a topic that absolutely grips you and takes over your life, first of all, that's a great way to be because then you're obsessed and you don't give up easily. But that's what happened. I think there's something in the universe, you know, some power in the universe that decides these things somehow. And it sends you a download that this is going to be your project. You know, you're going to write this book. And so you don't sit there sort of thinking, well, what's going to be my next topic? And maybe I'll do it. Maybe I'll do this. The real topics find you. And that's what happened to me. And that's what happened with John Mack. I mean, he didn't expect to run across alien abduction. But it found him.
So do you have any input from your wife? Seriously, because these topics that you get involved with, like the mafia and like, you know, alien abductions, these are heavy, heavy topics. Does she ever say, Ralph, too much?
She's happy that I found, you know, something that occupies me and leads to successful books. And, you know, John Mack had the same situation with his wife, Sally. He put her through a lot because he was always, dealing with abductees or experiencers in his house. He would be interviewing them. They'd scream and yell. And she'd had it. Now, I don't have that problem in my house. My wife supports me. We don't have abductees in the house. But it does take a toll on a relationship because obviously when one partner is completely involved in a project, it puts a burden on the other. And my wife has her own book project. She's an author too. So I understand when she's, you know, consumed with the project. So, but yeah, it puts a lot of pressure on people.
Now, since you were talking about alien abduction and you were studying it, have you had any instances in your own life? I mean, besides the internet going out and stuff like that, I'm kidding, but you know, have you had any real?
You know what? I did. And it happened not long ago. I was writing a piece which ran in the New York Times on Robert Bigelow, who's a billionaire in Nevada, who has developed space modules for the International Space Station, and he also funds paranormal research. And he funded John Mack, among other people. So I was doing the New York story for the New York Times on his. He's sponsoring a contest for the best information on the afterlife. Which is running now. So people are writing in their experiences, and he's going to award more than $1 million to people who have the best evidence of an afterlife. So I'm writing a story about him, and I'm lying in bed thinking how I'm going to, you know, deal with this information and what should I say. And suddenly there's a tremendous explosion, like bam! And the window to our terrace, the door, the glass door blew out.
Jesus.
And I was just thinking, you know, what am I going to say, you know, about the afterlife? And then there's bam, and the window explodes. So the window is completely shattered. So people said afterwards, well, it was probably, you know, unequal pressure or a bird hit it. Well, I didn't see any birds on the terrace. And we're on the 12th floor, so no rock came up from the street. So I don't know. Was it a natural occurrence? Probably, but it freaked me out.
Hell yeah, man. When you went to the guys to replace it, did you tell the people, you know, they said, what happened?
Yeah,
they said,
well,
what happened?
Well, they didn't care much. They were just happy to, you know, to get paid to replace the door. I told my editor, hey, you know, whatever you're paying me for the article, I got to pay, you know, $1,000 for a new door.
Write that off, yeah.
Yeah, you know, this story cost me $1,000, but that wasn't his problem. But that was a freaky experience. I can't say, you know, I've never been abducted as far as I know. I never saw a UFO, and neither did John Mack. He was kind of disappointed in his life that, hey, I want to see some of the stuff myself. And then he reflected and he said, no, it's probably a good thing because now I'm pure and I come to this as a, you know, researcher and not as a participant. So nobody can accuse me of, you know, just writing about my own experience or myself. So in the end, I think it was good for him to be an outsider, but he was very disappointed.
Yeah. All right. So listen, we're going to move on because your topic today is about the mafia, but I do want to tell people that you should buy The Believer. It really is a stunning book, Alien Encounters, Hard Science, and the Passion of John Mack. And you can buy it from Skylight Bookstore because you guys know I work there. Skylightbooks.com. Buy it from Skylight. Come on, you guys. It's your favorite neighborhood bookstore, even if you don't live in the neighborhood.
Right. They ship and they have signed labels with my name on it. So they'll paste the labels
in. Yeah, that's really cool.
So you can get an autographed book from Skylight Books Los Angeles. Listen to Christine.
That's nice of you. Thank you. Okay, so here's my next question. Tell me about this longevity at the New York Times.
Oh, boy. Well, I started there in 1964 as a copy boy, and it was a very different era. You know, we worked on typewriters. It's, you know, black telephones. Everybody had one telephone, no cell phone, no laptops. You wrote your story on paper. You gave it to a copy boy like me. He would carry it to the editor. Then it went up to the composing room, and a big linotype machine would turn it into lead type. I mean, it sounds like, you know, Gutenberg, the Dark Ages. But
And it was 30 years ago.
Yeah, it wasn't that long ago. And now you tell the kids today, you know, when we wanted to know something, we had to go to the library to get that book out. You couldn't look it up on your cell phone, you know.
So as a copy boy, is that the lowest?
That's as low as you can get. You get coffee.
Lower than the mailroom.
It's about the same. I did that too.
And so you just basically run around to different floors delivering
exactly.
things.
Exactly. A reporter types a story or one page of a story and yells copy. And you run over and take it from him and you run it to the editor. And then he says, boy, get me a cup of coffee. A boy, do this. You know. So, and there were no girls yet as copy boys yet. The girls came later, copy girls. But so that's how I started. But I started writing stories for the Times on my own, giving them to the editor. And they liked those stories. And then they would slip me an assignment now and then. And I got put on the staff pretty quickly. So, yeah, I had a great career there. I mean, I was the Westchester correspondent for a while, the suburban correspondent. And then they sent me to Vietnam. So I was a foreign correspondent. I was a war correspondent. I was in Cambodia. And then I was in Germany.
For how long?
Well, I was in Germany for a year, and then I went to Vietnam for about over a year, which was a great experience because, you know, Vietnam in 1969 was pretty much still the height of the war, and, you know, saw a lot of bad stuff, and, you know, it made me a much better reporter. Again, you know, we had to file our stories by telex and cable. You couldn't type it into a laptop and send it electronically. You had to type it on a typewriter and give the copy to a telex office, the cable to New York. So it was a different era.
Said that was a great time being in Vietnam.
It was great to be a correspondent. Yeah, it was an ugly time for America. I saw the protests here before I went. When I came back, it was a horrible time, and it was a horrible time there for the Vietnamese people, for sure, for our troops who were getting, you know, massacred there, for the drugs that, you know, a lot of guys came back drug addicted because they couldn't cope, the soldiers, with the horrors of war, so they started taking drugs. It was a terrible time, but if you were a reporter covering it, it was exciting. It gave you an experience you would never ever duplicate again.
Was it dangerous?
It was dangerous at times. I had colleagues and friends who were shot down in helicopters, who stepped on mines, who every night we had to carry our stories to an office where they would be telexed to New York, and there was a curfew, so you weren't supposed to be out on the street. So if anybody out on the street could get shot, but we had to go out on the street and carry our stories to the office. So there was a lot of danger, and I did know people who were killed over there. And
I thought that within the military they had reporters. No.
Well, they had military. I mean, we used the military transport. We traveled on helicopters, for example.
The
military had some of its own correspondents on Stars and Stripes, for example. But all the, you know, reporters were civilian. And there was no censorship then, by the way. You know, unlike World War II, we could say whatever we wanted. And I guess the army afterwards thought that wasn't such a great idea. They would have liked to censor us. But that's how the anti-war protest started, because we correspondents were sending back stories of what was really happening in Vietnam. And it was contrary to what the military was saying was happening. So they would have liked to censor us, but they didn't.
I could talk to you forever. It's also fascinating. One more thing, and then we're going to get to your real story, today about the Mafia book. But in the last couple of years, you know, with Donald Trump in office and everything, and then you started seeing this different propaganda that was put out by news stations. I mean, what were you thinking? Were you thinking like, Jesus, this is our worst nightmare?
Well, you know, that period of time, when the president called us enemies of the people, was terrible. We were news reporters, and we're trying to get the real story out, and we were fighting our own government. It was a terrible time. I don't want to get into politics, but I got to tell you that, first of all, for the news media, it was a good time because we had a lot to write about. I mean, there's a lot of interesting conflict in the country, including with our own president. So that made for compelling, you know, news coverage. But for the country, we went through a terrible period. But don't get me started.
No, I know. I just thought because you have, I mean, you're obviously well respected, and you've been working with the New York Times for so long. It's just fascinating, your body of work. And I just thought, now you see this shit. Was that an instance where you would say, no, I'm not covering it? It's too crazy.
No, I would never say that. You know, again, when you're targeted by the administration as press is the enemy, that's awful, because then people are being told not to trust your reporting, and that's terrible. We did the best job we could under very bad circumstances. We didn't get the right information. I wasn't covering the White House, so I'm not speaking as personally. I was off the staff by then. I was a freelancer. I contributed to the Times on different things, but I know from my colleagues what they went through, and it was a very tough time. On the other hand, it was a very exciting time to be a journalist. And I tell my students when I teach journalism, this is a great time. This being the time of the Trump administration is a great time to be a journalist because there's so much to cover.
Wow. Where do you teach?
Well, I was teaching at Baruch College of the City University of New York.
Oh, that's right.
I'm a distinguished lecturer there.
I saw that,
I had a regular journalism class for a while, and then I teach classes on fake news and how to distinguish true from fake. So I keep my hand in.
Wow. Hey, you know what? Maybe you've done it in the past. Have you ever taken like those really high-end cruises where you're the lecturer and so you get a free trip?
I've done some of that. Actually, the Times has sponsored, these cruises where they ask for reporters to... There's my wife.
Sorry. Hi.
I moved into the bedroom for a better connection. The Times had these cruises where they would bring reporters on, pay them to go and lecture on the way. And you could, if you were a health expert, you could talk about health coverage. If you were a sports writer, you know, you could talk about covering,
best gig ever.
Sports. Yeah. So I didn't do any of those yet. They asked me a few times, but I have lectured quite a bit.
Yeah, I bet you have. All right, you guys. So before we get over to Ralph's story, I did want to remind everybody that we're playing Story Smash, the storytelling game show, every Friday night live on Facebook and YouTube. Head over to storysmashshow.com to find out more about the game. And if you want to play, just fill out the little form on the website, and I will definitely put you in the game. Storysmashshow.com, and also follow Story Smash on Instagram at Story Smash. All right, you guys, he's here right now. You've heard him talking, Ralph Blumenthal. Like we talked about, he was a reporter for the New York Times from 1964 to 2009 and has written 7 books based on investigative crime reporting and cultural history. Now, like we said, he's got a new book right now, The Believer, Alien Encounters, Hard Science, and The Passion of John Mack. And you can find out more at ralphblumenthal.com. By the way, great website, Ralph. Whoever's doing your site, good job.
RalphBlumenthal.com. and yeah, buy the really, book from Skylight Books in Los That's Angeles. It. Signed copies available.
That's right. All right, you guys, wherever you are, put your hands together for Ralph Blumenthal.
Hey, thank you, Christine. So I'm going to tell a story. I love telling stories, by the way, because that's my business as a reporter. And the story I'm going to tell really goes back some years in the days before COVID, well before COVID, when book tours were not virtual. They were real and physical, and you actually went to the places to talk about your book. So I had written a book about the mafia. It was called Last Days of the Sicilians. It was about the Pizza Connection, which was a big FBI drug investigation where the mafia was using pizza parlors to traffic heroin and bring in large amounts of cash, $1 billion worth. So I wrote this book called Last Days of Sicilians, and I got my publisher, which was Random House Times Books, was sending me around, and one of the stops was San Francisco. So this is the story. I was booked into a top floor room at the San Francisco Westin St. Francis Hotel on Union Square, a lovely hotel, and I was really exhausted. I saw that they had booked me into suite 3178. Remember that. It came with a wet bar in the foyer and beautiful Biedermeier furniture, a marble bath with gold fixtures, panoramic view over beautiful San Francisco. And I remember parting the drapes and looking out over the beautiful city, the lights, the hills. And I was pretty exhausted because I had left Boston 7 hours earlier. That was my last stop on the book tour. And so for me, it was like 2 a.m. I unpacked my bags, I laid out my toiletries, and got ready to go to bed. I was exhausted. So earlier, to just take a step back, I had gotten out of the taxi, checked into the hotel, walked through the lobby, and the lobby was really full of people at that hour. I was kind of surprised. It was so full of people that I couldn't even find a bellhop to take up my bag. So I carried it up myself and checked into the beautiful room, I said, which was then at $150 a night, which was a pretty good bargain. I didn't pay, my publisher paid. And the living room, I noticed in this beautiful suite, had a big conference table and a couch and chairs and seemed to have everything but a bed. So I'm tired, right? So I'm looking around for the bed, and I figured, well, it must be a couch bed that they didn't make up yet. So I'm pulling at the couch, but there's no sofa bed there. It was not a bed. And then I said, there must be a Murphy bed in this room. So I'm feeling around the walls like the Hardy Boys for a secret Murphy bed, but there's no Murphy bed. So what am I going to do? I'm exhausted and there's no bed in the room. So I thought maybe I'll call down to the desk and say, well, what would I say? That I'm an investigative reporter and I can't find the bed. So I was kind of, shy about that. And I'm still looking for the bed. And now it's about 3 o'clock in the morning and I didn't care how it looked. So I snatched up the phone and I, barked down to the reception desk that I could not find the bed. Or either that, or California does things differently than the rest of the world, and maybe the hotel rooms don't come with beds. Maybe that's how cool they are in California, that they don't even give guests beds, And then I said, well, maybe that's laid back, but that's not even laid back because there was no bed. So anyway, I figured, well, this is maybe some weird California thing. Meanwhile, still no bed. So I got back, I got dressed again, and I rode down to the lobby, 31 floors. And the lobby was still full of people, but I found a woman in a blue uniform who's a reception clerk. And I said, look, I carried my own bags up, and I'll carry a bed up if I have to, but I need a bed. So she said she's going to send up a bed. So I go back to the room and I wait. And 15 minutes later, there's a knock on the door. The great, open the door, and there's a bellhop with a bed, a rollaway bed of all things. So he rolls it into the room and makes the bed and smooths the sheets. And I look at the bed, and it is laden with dust. There's big cobwebs under the bed, and it must have been in a closet for a long time. I mean, nobody used this bed for a long time. So it was really sickening. So, I was desperate to lie down. and sleep, but I'm not going to sleep in this bed. So I told the bellhop, look, take this bed away and bring me a clean bed, okay? So he goes away, and a few minutes later, knocks on the door again with what looked like another bed. I thought it was probably the same bed, and they just wiped away the cobwebs, but it looked like the same bed. Anyway, so it was a very lumpy bed, and but I was so tired, I lay down on it, but I couldn't even sleep by this time because I was so upset. And I turned on the TV, and I started flipping channels, and I come across something on the TV that was really weird. I'm looking at this movie or something on the TV, and it looked strangely familiar. And I realized this is the St. Francis Hotel. I'm looking at the St. Francis Hotel, and there's something going on. There's a big crowd there in the lobby milling around, and there's a yacht outside steaming into the harbor like a giant, you know, royal yacht. And it's coming under the Golden Gate Bridge. And I hear the narrative, and they're saying that, you know, the Queen Elizabeth of England is coming to San Francisco, and she's steaming under the Golden Gate Bridge, you know, and she's staying at the St. Francis. So I said, well, this is amazing. That's why there was such a big crowd in the lobby, and that's why they put me in a room with no bed, because the Queen is here, and there was even pictures of the President. At the time, President Reagan and Vice President Bush welcoming the Queen to San Francisco. I said, this is amazing. How could I have missed this? And, you know, I had picked up the papers at the airport and I didn't see any of this. It was just so crazy. So I figured, well, the Queen must be staying. That's why all the rooms were taken. That's why they stuck me in a conference suite without a bed. And I said, well, that's pretty great. So I finally got to sleep. So the next morning I dialed, you know, room service and asked for the newspaper, looking for the big headlines about the Queen. And there's nothing in the paper about the Queen. So I said, this is really one cool town, man. The Queen comes to visit and it doesn't even make the paper. So when they bring up the breakfast, the room service breakfast, I say to the guy, wow, this is amazing. The Queen is staying here, right? And he gives me this weird look, and he says, the Queen? And I said, yeah, Queen Elizabeth. Isn't she staying here? And he says, yeah, about, you know, 3-4 years ago. So I'm thinking, now I realize I was looking at the hotel channel that showed great moments in the history of the St. Francis Hotel. So I was looking at, you know, 3-4 years ago, so the Queen was there, but not now. So I still didn't understand why I was stuck in this room without a bed. Anyway, I thought I had stepped into one of those movies where, you know, you wake up at the end and say, but it was only a dream? Anyway, so I said, you know, if I had been, you know, displaced by the Queen, I would have understood it, but I was stood up by a bed. So that's the story.
Okay, so what did they say? What did they say downstairs at the desk? I don't get it.
It was all screwed up. But, you know, when you go on a book tour, I found out, you have a lot of experiences like this. Things go wrong all the time. And, you know, your publicity agent or your publisher makes the plans and they book you at these things. And then everything goes wrong. It's the wrong day or nobody shows up at your reading. I've done, you know, book readings where there was no audience at all. I did a book reading once where, you know, I talked about my book and I read sections of the book. And afterwards, a woman came up to the stage and she said, I really enjoyed your talk, but do you have anything in writing? I said, well, how about my book?
It
can be a trial to be a, you know, an author on tour. So if you got time for one more story, I'll tell you what happened to me in Los Angeles, but we're probably running out of time.
Well, I wouldn't mind hearing that. Well, no, I think, I mean, let me hear it because you're such a good storyteller. This is great.
Okay, so on the same book tour, I was booked on a radio station in Los Angeles, and I forgot which one, but it was late at night. And in those days, you know, there wasn't virtual like this where you could just, you know, call in from wherever you were. You had to go to the studio. So I was running from studio to studio. So I went to this one studio, did the radio show, and afterwards, it was late at night, it was like midnight, and they called me a cab to go back to my hotel. So I get in the cab, and we're riding through. It was a different time. The cities were very dangerous then, including Los Angeles, a lot of crime. And I get into a conversation with the driver, and I say, it must be dangerous to be driving a cab at night. And he said, he pats his pocket, and he says, not with this. So I said, oh, my God, you're armed. He said, that's right. So I said, did you ever have occasion to, you know, to use your weapon? And he said, well, he said, the other night, it was late at night, I was taking a guy, looked kind of sketchy, and he's in the back seat, and I hear a click, and I realize he's just opened up his knife. And I grab my gun, and I turn around, I point in his face, and I say, okay, and he used an obscenity, okay, give me the knife. So he handed me the knife, the driver's telling me, the cabbie, and I break it in half, and I throw it out of the window. He says, and then I point the gun in his face, and I say, okay, give me your wallet. I said, wait a minute, you robbed him? He said, that's right. He says, I took his wallet and I threw him out of the cab. So I said, this is crazy stuff. that was just a little story in Los Angeles.
That's hilarious. Yeah. You know, in my neighborhood, there are still houses that have bars on their windows. For the most part, they've been taken down now. But I guess in the 70s, it was pretty damn dangerous.
Oh, man. I mean, you know, I remember waking up to the sound of car alarms all over, you know, and people would, you don't remember this, but people would put signs in the window of their cars, you know, radio already stolen. Because they didn't want anybody breaking the window and not finding the radio.
These are big words from somebody who lives in New York.
Well, we're tough. We're used to it. But, you know, people, you know, beyond a certain, or too young, let's say, to remember, don't remember how bad the crime was. Yeah. And, you know, with the car alarms every night and people, you know, breaking. The apartment I lived in years ago when I started the New York Times was broken into twice.
That's horrible. That's such an invasion. You just feel like so gross, like somebody was in my car.
Yeah, it was a tough time, but yeah, we've come a long way.
I know you don't work for the New York Times now, but when you worked for the New York Times, because I've never really sat down with a journalist like this, did they assign you projects, Ralph? They said, you go to Vietnam. We want you over there.
Yeah, for that. Well, they give you a choice. You don't have to go to Vietnam if you don't want to go to Vietnam. I mean, that was a prize assignment, so people would jump at that. But everyday stories, they would often come to the reporter and say, hey, there's a fire, you know, downtown. You got to cover it, and you don't have a choice. You got to go. And that's mainly for so-called general assignment reporters who wait around for something to happen, and then when you know, the news breaks somewhere, the reporter is sent off. But very often I had a subject area of expertise, like I was covering culture news. So I would cover the opera or Broadway, and I would come up with my own stories. And usually the reporters then know more than the editors about what's happening in their field. So if you're like a health reporter covering COVID, you know what's going on more than the editor. So you'd come in and say, oh, I found out that there's a new trial going on and I want to cover that. So they give reporters a lot of leeway to come up with their own stories. But it's both. There has to be a group of reporters standing by to cover whatever breaks.
It's interesting. I think it's a fascinating field. I really do.
It is. It's a great field. And I tell, you know, students when I teach journalism that it is the most wonderful field because it's always exciting. There's a lot of ego feedback because you see your name in the paper. People come to you and they think, you know, they think you're a celebrity. Oh, you work for the paper, you know, and you meet interesting people. It's challenging. It's very fulfilling because you see your words, you know, in the paper. It's a great career.
So let me ask you one more question and then we got to wrap it up. Do you have any passion projects now that, like, you know, you got to get it out? Like, do you think there's like, oh my gosh, I have to write about what?
Wow. I'm still coming down from the highs of this book, The Believer, because it took me 16 years from beginning to end.
Oh, Ralph, that's such an accomplishment. Congratulations.
Well, you know, it was kind of an ordeal at times because I watched entire buildings go up in my neighborhood in the time when I was working on this book. And I was wondering, am I going to finish my book before this building wow. goes up? And sure enough, the building went up, you know, before I finished the book. So I spent a lot of time, not every day, you know, 12 hours a day for 16 years, but on and off. It took from the very beginning 16 years. So I'm still very attached to that project. I'm still doing a lot of, you know, events for it. I'm talking about it a lot. My head is still sure. there. There's a lot more to, you know, to be written about. It's the mystery remains. You know,
for
what
sure.
is this phenomenon?
For sure. Yeah. Do you think this phenomena is going to be solved in our lifetimes?
Maybe not in our lifetime, but, you know, we're learning a lot more about UFOs. The government has become more forthcoming. We at the New York Times released these Navy videos of pilots, you know, chasing UFOs or UFOs chasing pilots.
Well, just a couple of weeks ago, there was an American Airlines pilot who saw a ship go over his plane.
Yeah, exactly right. I mean, it's happening all the time. And now commercial pilots, unlike before, are being encouraged to report these things. You know, it used to be pilots were told, commercial pilots, do not mention UFOs. You'll lose your license. We don't want to hear about it. And Navy pilots were told, do not report UFOs. They'll think you're crazy. And now we've really come a long way with the government saying, we want these reports. And they're going to be issuing some kind of report maybe this summer that was mandated by the Defense Authorization Act. So the government has to do some kind of a report on, you know, where things stand. So we're hoping something more will come out. But, you know, I think we'll learn more about UFOs before we'll learn about aliens or alien abduction or whoever might be behind the UFOs, because that is really speculative. Mm-hmm. And nobody knows that.
Mm-hmm. Well, except there is some documentation of, like, young girls, young women, and young boys being abducted. I mean,
well, when you say documentation, there are a lot of anecdotal accounts. And as I said, John Mack, the guy I wrote about in The Believer, the Harvard psychiatrist, collected these accounts. He interviewed these people. He believed that they were telling the truth on some level, that they encountered something that can't be explained. So, but the level of verification of these events is far less than the verification of UFOs. We know now from the Navy videos that these objects have physicality, that they really do exist. They don't know what they are, but there's something that operates in the skies and underwater, because pilots have seen these things going into and coming out of the water.
Wow.
Wow. I mean, that's a mind blower.
It really is. I didn't realize that. These things move so fast and they make these turns so quickly.
Right.
That's so advanced.
Yeah. I mean, the aerodynamics are so incredible. That's why the government is trying to figure out how do we the U.S., you know, obtain this technology, because we need it for defense. We need it for offense, military thinking goes. And we don't want the Russians or we don't want the Chinese to get a hold of this, whatever it is. So there's kind of a race to understand this technology. But it would be nice if all the countries in the world cooperated to figure it out, because everyone has an interest in, you know, the power sources that this would, you know, entail. But there really is a race going on to understand this technology.
Well, it's just fascinating. You never know. They might have water, you know.
Right.
Anything. I don't know why people would disbelieve in terms of, like, there's so much we don't know. Like,
right.
How could anybody purport to really think one way, you know, how could anybody purport to completely deny?
Right.
It doesn't make sense.
I agree with you 100%. I think that some of the skeptics who have like a knee-jerk reaction, oh, that's impossible. I have a quote in my book that says, I never said it was possible. I only said it was true. So, you know, of course it's impossible.
That's great.
You know,
yeah,
how could it be possible? And yet these stories seem to be true. So, thank you.
Well, this has been just fabulous. And I really appreciate you sitting down with me, Ralph. You're such an interesting man. And I am definitely watching you. Maybe you'll do another alien book. Maybe you'll take it further.
Who knows? But thanks for the opportunity. It's always a pleasure to be with you, Christine. And I love your interviewing and I love your shows. So good luck and buy your books from Skylight Books in Los Angeles.
All right, you guys, I got to wrap it up. I want to thank you so much again for tuning into Storyworthy. Make sure you check out Ralph's website, ralphblumenthal.com. It's a really good site. And then make sure you check out my site, storyworthypodcast.com, which will lead you to all sorts of other good stuff. All right, you guys, one more time on behalf of the very talented and interesting Ralph Blumenthal. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Christine.
My name is Christine Blackburn saying, make it a Storyworthy week.
Thanks for joining us on the Storyworthy Podcast. We'll be back next week with all new stories. Subscribe to Storyworthy on iTunes and visit the Storyworthy website at storyworthypodcast.com.